This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/TrekFM. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi there, everybody. This is Vic Mignogna, Captain Kirk from Star Trek Continues, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, I'm Tony Robinson, and welcome to Continuing Mission. For the last 5 years, Sam Cockings has been working on and fine-tuning his soon-to-be-released Star Trek fan film entitled Temporal Anomaly. Filmmaking is Sam's passion, and he does amazing work in CGI and visual effects. He's also the co-host of the Trek Yards web series, where a lot of his work can be found. He's joining me today on Continuing Mission to discuss his work and how it all began. So let's go and visit with Sam Cockings. We'll get into the turbo lift and say hello. Welcome to Continuing Mission, Sam Cockings.
Hello. Great to finally be on Trek FM after years of listenership.
Trying. Well, we have a long list, Sam, and we finally got around to you. That's not true, but I tried to make myself or Trek FM sound great in that moment in time. Sam, where do you come from?
Oh, England, the originator of all the Americas, or North America. Yeah, England, Bedford region, if you want to be more specific, near Milton Keynes and 40 minutes north of London.
And but you're not living in the UK right now.
Oh, no, I am. Yeah, I do all my work from, transcontinental.
Okay. For some reason, I got the idea that you were living in Canada for...
that's my partner in crime. Good crime, Trek.
Trek working.
I thought you had uprooted and gone over to the other side, the dark side. People know you mostly from... Trek Yards, which is a video podcast, video blog.
Web series, we like to call it.
And most people tend to know you from there. How did you get involved with Trek Yards?
Well, it was actually I'm a big lover of Star Trek since I was two. My dad showed me the Cold Might Maneuver and just grew up on everything Trek and then watched the end of it, you know, live. And then I got into filmmaking. That was my big passion, but I've always loved ships. And after some fan film work, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, I just got talking to this guy online. It was his birthday, and I was starting to make visual effects for my film. I just make him a birthday present for an animation, and I did, and he loved it. And within about 2 months, we decided to make a web show about starships. I'm not really sure why, just it made sense, and it was sounded like a fun thing to do. And because of my filmmaking background, I took it very seriously, and now... 3 and a bit years later, we're over 300 episodes and 11 million views.
Wow. So you're a multimillionaire.
In views, not in bank balance.
Yeah. Imagine if you could get a dollar or a pound for every show you made.
The amount of Trek sets I've recreated by now, I would have done a few.
Or rather, every view that occurred on the show, that'd be fantastic. Yeah. Did you study film as a genre, or did you go to a film school particularly?
Well, I on a family trip to America, I made a short film movie with my cousin. And when I got back, I was hooked. I found my thing. You know, when we're all young, we wonder, what do we want to do? And I just couldn't stop thinking about making films. So I ended up making a whole web series in my high school and knew very quickly that's what I wanted to do. And so I went to university for film for 4 years, got my degree. Was so sort of enthusiastic that I managed to get full paid work outside the university and inside the university around my course. So to pay for the course, even bought my own camera equipment. And I'm so well known by them that I'm brought back every year as a guest lecturer and what I've done. So yeah, filmmaking is definitely my thing.
What was the first piece of work that, you know, that you created that someone watched and said, oh, that's really cool? Or,
well, for 15-year-old, it's all relative, isn't it? But the first one I was very proud of was episode 7 of my web series, in which, spoilers, I have a death scene of my own character near the end, and it's artistically shot, and there's a pool of blood, and it's really nicely, you know, everythinged, and you generally feel sad for this character that I'd created, and I remember thinking, wow, that worked, you know, learn thing, and I feel about what I'm good at is cinematography, is working on angles, is picking that, and as my real skills have improved over the decade and a bit, those core principles have allowed me to keep on growing with that.
So it's safe to say that this is a career path for you. You're definitely heading in the direction of cinematography. Yeah.
Yeah, I just can't stop.
But you've kind of ventured into CGI development as well, haven't you? So I was going to say it's not necessarily camera work, but it is camera work of sorts, because when you're looking at the screen, it's like looking through the viewfinder on a camera, or, you know, down straight through the lens. You're just seeing it there in your face.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you need to know good cinematography to be able to create good shots. Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the first things I remember thinking when I was a kid that loved Star Trek is I wish I could make shots of spaceships flying. And so when I got to fan film work and I wanted to do that and learn it myself, I thought, well, I could ask others, or I could do it myself. And so 5 years of learning that, and now I'm, you know, have the skills and the experience to be able to create many, many types of space CG and create what I can envision in my head. And it's a real thrill. I never get tired of making space CG because I love space CG.
Yeah. I could sit all day, and on a personal level, I could sit all day and watch the Enterprise just flying through a starfield.
And it's funny, if you look at, you know, 300 episodes of Trek Yards, and at least 100 of them, 150, have space CG visuals in them. That was one thing we wanted to do from day one, was create original work. Wasn't just reuse clips from the show, wasn't just use fan art, it was to create something new, stuff you hadn't seen before. And so I, you know, creating about 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 shots in all those episodes, I've probably created hundreds and, you know, 500, 600, 700 space CG shots, and more than that, close to 1,000, through all the Trek Yards. So I've been creating on a weekly basis almost space Trek CG. And probably done the most CG out of anybody in the last 2 decades for Trek, just the pure volume of flybys and beauties and, you know, scale shots. It's crazy. And the amount of things, you know, when we did our Akira class episode, you know, Akira First Introduced and First Contact, I said to myself, well, what can I do that's never been done before? And I did the Akira class at Warp, and we'd never seen that before. And so if you tuned in, you saw something truly original and truly canon and truly, you know, that's amazing. You know, I love doing those sorts of unique things.
Are you a fan of anybody else who also does CGI and you go, oh, that's good, oh, I'm going to do that one, I'm going to copy that one?
Oh, yeah. I'm barely halfway, you know, a third of the way down the road. I mean, obviously in the Trek community, Tobias Richter does beautiful stuff. You know, it is both his passion, his love, and his profession. You can really see that in the work he's produced, both in his independent work and his Trek work. You know, he understands cinematography, he understands lighting. And I've said before, he does Trek 2.0, you know, really beautiful, really painting-like, really elegant. I like doing Trek 1.5 in my space CG. It's like, it looks like the shows and the movies, but a bit more dynamic if they didn't have the same restrictions that they had placed on them. Because I've talked to people that worked in the CG department, and, you know, Rob Bonshoon is a good friend of mine who worked on Voyager and DS9, and the motion picture director's cut. You know, he told me hours and hours of stories of you know, how the directors wouldn't allow people to do CG shots of certain angles, because they said the audience couldn't understand a ship upside down, or a ship, you know, going, you know, the axis rather than the Y axis, whatever. And I don't correspond to those rules, because people are smart, and this is a Trek fan film for Trek audiences, and I think we certainly want to see that stuff. But other people, I mean, anything at ILM tends to impress me. I mean, they are absolutely the gods of CG. I have to remember a lot of names. I want to get all the names right, but yes, there's a lot of fan people out there. Most people don't do animations, though. That's kind of more specialized. There's some amazing people that do pictures, but I like to capture the motion. That's a big thing about me. You can make a picture a lot more perfect, but emotion has a certain story behind it, and I like that story to be told.
Talking about seeing starships from different angles, and did somebody say to you, no, it must go left to right, it must be right side up, you know, it has to be recognized like a liner leaving port. You don't see a liner from underneath or whatever. But when the 2009 Star Trek movie came out, there's an opening shot of the Kelvin, and for a brief moment you haven't got a clue what you're looking at. There's all these noises and lights passing by your face, and then when the ship finally, you know, fills the screen, you don't know if it's upside down or downside up. They twisted and turned it. Mm. So is that the kind of thing you're more interested in?
I mean, that was a beautiful shot. The whole scene is beautiful. Yeah, I mean, go with the flow, have some momentum, look at ships in different ways. Use focal lengths in a different way, which is how far zoomed the camera is, the CG camera, because that can change the look and the feel. You know, playing around with things, adding nebula like Tobias does, but he has a great set of preset backgrounds. Just trying to be a bit different and yet still conform, because Trek Yard is a documentary web series, and so, you know, if I'm creating a new CG sequence of, say, a bird of prey at warp, it should look and feel like a bird of prey at warp. There shouldn't be anything too snazzy about it, but it can, you know, we've got better processing power now, and we've got the hours to just render things. So do a bit more interesting stuff with it, and light it a bit differently that could look a bit sexier and still Trek, though, you know.
Has anyone set a benchmark for you that you one day are going to? Set your own benchmark, in other words.
I in one of my conversations with Rob Bonshoon, I showed him some shots, because I love getting feedback from Tobias and Doug Drexler and Rob Bonshoon, because, I mean, they are masters. I mean, you can't, you know, they are masters. And Rob said to me, is this shot done? And I thought for a second, and I said, well, no, despite it being called Final One. And he said, yeah, that's the right answer, because no shot is ever really done, and you can never really learn enough, and you can never get to the end of that journey. It's always a learning curve. And, you know, as I've remastered this fan film that we'll talk about in a bit, you know, I keep upgrading what I can do. The same models, the same scenes, even the same angles, but my knowledge enhances as times go by. My subtlety, you know, getting the right light at the right angle to know how to light a ship that's more beautiful, less heavy-handed, you know, to create a better effect, that sort of thing. It's all a learning curve, and I hope to, you know, never stop learning, because, you know, they'll all get better, and I hope to always get better, you know.
Do you collaborate with anybody, or just, you just go solo and you say, right, I'm going to stick my head in front of this program until it's finished? Or do you say, I've done this far, but, you know, could you take over and perhaps put some lighting effects on this side or that side or the other side?
That's a good question. For Trek Yards, I'm the only one that could spend the time doing it, because Trek Yards is my full-time job. And so most people don't have 8 hours a day, you know, 5, 6, 7 days a week to do this stuff. And I've often spent 20 hours doing space CG shots before I even edit the show, because I want to create that level of quality. And so there is no one else that, you know, I could say, right, could you spend 9 hours, please, of your working week and get it to me by Friday, because it releases on Saturday. No one else can really do that. So, for the most part, it's always me, but like I said, I will ask people, once I get to a certain stage, you know, I want to get things to the point where I think they look good, because I've got this base in film and base in Trek, you know, does that look Trek enough? And if they say, I see this, I'm like, oh, I didn't see that, you know, those little things that their experience gives you that you just don't have. But yeah, for the most part, I do most of it myself. I'm very keen to work with directors that I work with on films to get their feedback. You know, I present a shot and I say, well, what do you think? This is what I think is great. And, you know, I take any notes on board. Do they want it longer, shorter, more dynamic? You know, at the end of the day, it's their shot. So that's kind of a collaboration. You know, I'm not the end all be all, especially on someone else's project, you know.
And just going back to the start of it all, because we're all used to CGI now, but and it's amazing that in certain areas you can't tell it's CGI, and I think that's the ultimate goal. But where did it start for you? I mean, what programs did you use, and are they, if you look back on them now, are they so archaic they might as well have been cavemen, you know, scribbling on a wall somewhere?
That's a really good question. I mean, I've done things down and dirty for a while. I mean, I've used Adobe After Effects my entire work, well, filming career, because I thought that was what I needed to get. You know, that's what they used as pro, need to get that. And so I remember for my web series, because, you know, in England, anywhere in the world, you can't really walk around with firearms, but it was an action-based web series. And so I used my sci-fi weapon collection, you know, pulse pistol from Farscape, force lance from Andromeda, you know, as the weapons for these characters. And so I had to put in digital effects as the blasts. I had to do that. And so I remember, I didn't know how to do that. So I just created, shapes. And then feathered the outsides and added a glow and then gave the motion blur and hand keyframed them across the screen to, you know, by hand, every frame, every shot. And some of these battles were quite, annoying. And so I, you know, start with the simplest thing. So that was certainly some of the first, you know, adding blood splats and things. But in terms of space CG, you know, I started out in Blender. Well, no, to be fair, I started out trying to cheat. The very first Temporal Anomaly teaser to try and get people, you know, to invest in the project. The best I could do, I love the video game Bridge Commander, which I think is probably the best Star Trek game ever made, with the mods. I mean, every ship, every era, every bridge, it's incredible. And one day I found this plugin that turned space green. So that's the green screen of what you need. And so I would put these ships in these, try and line them up, and I would record the screen and I would key out the background and suddenly I have ships. I can do a custom scene, but God, it's awful. It's really, really terrible. And please don't watch that promo, but you know, think about where I've come. So that was the first time doing CG, but I was like, no, I have to learn. I have to do better than this. So I started learning Blender, but I couldn't make that work. And so I thought, no, I'm going to go straight to what they used on Star Trek, because if they could make, you know, 15 seasons of Trek, and God knows how many movies in Lightwave, you know, I would get that. And so I started learning the way they did back in the day, and I've managed to, you know, build up my thought process and how I work things to kind of mimic the styles of Star Trek Voyager and Star Trek Enterprise, especially with the help of people like Rob Bonshoon, who have given me some nice tutorials throughout the years.
As time goes by, you're progressing, you're getting even more involved in. Are you finding the new upcoming computer programs that allow you to render these models more difficult to work with or more complicated to work with? Or do you just go, yeah, no problem, flick a switch and I'm in?
Well, I'm not a professional visual effects person. I mean, this is purely hobby, or I guess professional for Trek Yards if you count that. But the aim has always been to create Star Trek space visual effects. And so there is a certain bar that you can get to. And the program Lightwave 3D, which amazingly actually just came out with a new version after like 4 or 5 years. It was the premier software for, you know, 2 decades, then really fell by the wayside as it wasn't being updated. And so I was using an inferior software, as it were, to try and create stuff that was meant to look like the late, you know, early 2000s and late 90s. So I wasn't pushing anyone's software to the limit. Processing power maybe, because, you know, 1080p is always a struggle, especially with some of the big models. But I mean, nowadays people use Maya, Tobias Rich use Maya, and most of the professionals in the world use Maya because it's incredibly versatile and can do things that Lightwave just can't. So I'm not trying to keep up with things in that way, because I want to create a documentary web series that, you know, if I can make ships like I do on Trek, and that was always the goal. And in fact, in the last year, I've learned through my work on Trek Yards and our spin-off Fleet Yards that some of my favorite sci-fis of all time, you know, Stargate, Firefly, Battlestar Galactica, Babylon 5, all created in Lightwave. And so you're looking at the best sci-fis of the 2000s, to which they are the best sci-fis, some of them of the last 30 years, all created in Lightwave. So, you know, if I ever want to create a scene that looks like those guys, I can do that. And that's my childhood, that's my teen years, that's my legacy, you know. So I'm not in it to necessarily create a photo reel, because it is still a hobby in essence, even if it takes my full time. Just create spaceships flying, I'm happy with.
Do you have a particular Star Trek era that you tend to focus on, or do you like them all, or do you just like Enterprise or Next Generation? Or
Do you mean for track yards, for VFX, or just personal preference?
You know, when you watch the Enterprise flying, you're my Enterprise is TOS.
Ah, it's so tricky, because each era has slightly different rules in VFX, and I try and mimic when I need to. You know, TOS is very static because it was a physical miniature, and even the remasters were trying to stay sort of true, but they're not lit very amazingly well, and that's now quite, it's over 10 years old, and they're quite dated. You know, TNG looks gorgeous, but again, very static. But that's the scale of the ship being represented. And it does have blinkies and more colour, which is always useful. Then you get to early Voyager, and then, you know, late Voyager and DS9. That's when CG comes in, and they do some wonderful things. And again, the blinky lights, the glows, the colour, that's what really appeals to me more. Then you jump back to NX-01 time, you get across, you get some glows, some not for aliens and not. But I don't like the ships as much, the hull reflections as much, you know, the shiny of the NX-01 doesn't appeal to me as much as the clean lines of the, you know, you can make Voyager and Defiant look incredible. NX-U can too, but hasn't got that same love. And that must link in some respect to the Enterprise refit, 71. 71 and 71A, because that's that coral beautiful hull with self-illumination. That was the first one to say, here's the beautiful hull, here's a beautiful design, but self-lit, which allows us to have harsh shadows, because suddenly you light it from a certain point, you get the key light, you get the fill, but you don't need to be afraid of the darkness because it can light itself. And going back and lighting TOS for some of the fan films that I do, it's actually very limiting because they didn't use self-illumination. And so you've got to overlight. Whereas things like the Enterprise E, the Voyager, you can be much more harsh with shadows and push it slightly further than they even did in the shows and create a more cinematic effect. So overall, I do like, you know, I think Voyager era the most in terms of lighting, because you have the colours, you have the blinkies, and you have those nice clean colours of the hull.
I'm just going to slightly go off topic in a sense, but we're talking about self-illumination of the ships. But my understanding of the Enterprise, particularly the refit as she leaves space dock, or prior to leaving space dock, the music is building, and you know, and suddenly all these lights start to come on. I always thought that she was being lit from reflectors or huge lights inside space dock, that they were highlighting the name of the ship, they were highlighting the registration of the ship, or you know, the logo of the United Federation of Planets, were highlighting certain sections, but the lighting was external and wasn't lit from any point on the ship. There weren't any, you know, searchlights or strobe lights or whatever it was pointing at the dock. So I know later people tried to include some lights on the ship to say, oh no, that light definitely came from the left and right nacelle. That came from underneath or above the saucer section. I never kind of really got into that, but it's become acceptable. So you have to kind of do it too. My question is going on forever, so I'll let you talk about that. But do you subscribe to the idea that Enterprise and subsequent ships light themselves, or do you kind of go with the idea she was lit from space dock before she left?
Well, having, you know, lit a lot of spaceships and just dissected their light rigs, I can very confidently say the CG ships were lit by themselves. But yeah, there's a certain concession with that. If you look at the refit obviously is your example. For the director's cut remaster of Motion Picture, they added a few more CG shots. They're quite hard to tell because they painstakingly tried. You know, Foundation Imaging was really good at that. And they built a certain rig and, you know, it's lit. You know, the pylon's being lit from the ship itself, there's underlights, there's, you know, light in the registry and stuff. But actually, you are correct in a sense. A couple of the lights, especially on the nacelles, don't actually come from a bulb. There's no practical way those lights can emanate from anywhere without magic, you know. And if you look at the light rig, they are so far out of the ship because the look has to exist even if the science doesn't make much sense. So, you know, the light rig was designed a certain way in the movie, and you can see it later on. But yeah, some of them have slight science concessions, I'll certainly agree to. But hey, they're there, they look great, so I'm fine with that.
poetic license, I guess.
Yeah.
Sorry, that question went on forever. Absolutely. I think part two of the question is next week. So, yeah, okay. But you now must have a huge archive of shots, flying shots. Are they all the same ship, or do you have different ships?
Well, every episode of Trek Yards is a different ship. So, yeah, I mean, dozens and dozens of ships, dozens and dozens of animations, and, you know, all lower than 720p resolution because, you know, having to render, well, having, it, my choice, but the quality we get from it is amazing. You know, rendering that many shots per episode, especially on earlier computers with less processing power, you know, 3 years and limited budget of a student, you can only afford to have such a powerful PC. They're all certain resolution. And they get better over time, but yeah, dozens and dozens, hundreds of shots, and some I'm very proud of, some have to be a simple flyby without any beauty, you know, which is why I like doing some of the fan film CGI I do, because I get to stretch the wings, you know, artistically and dramatically, pace-wise, and, you know, I've got a specific chap that demands quite a lot of quality and quite a lot of things, and I've had to really try and do new things this in the last would be 13 months on their project and obviously, hey, that's awesome, you know, I can now do more and better things. I mean, it's a learning curve, you know. I'll tell you if I can't do it, but if I probably can do it and I have to learn, well, I've learned the skill.
So you have a wireframe of the ship already there, and it has a surface. And then you add more detail to the surface as you go along.
Well, I'm not a 3D modeler. You know, I refer back to a great CG artist that hopefully most people will know in the Trek community, Adam Mojo Lebowitz, you know, nicknamed Mojo. He's a tremendous artist that's worked on, you know, Firefly and Battlestar and multiple Star Treks. And he is if anyone sees his profile, he can make immaculate, incredible lit scenes, images, beautiful stuff. But he can't model. You know, we're not all multi-talented in all the same way, because they are different skill sets. You know, on the Trek TV shows, they had an incredible modeling team. You know, Pierre Droulet is an amazing talent. You know, he did the Firefly, the Battlestar Galactica, an Enterprise, and dozens of others. You know, one of the best modelers in the world, I'd absolutely say. You know, and Brandon McDougall and Koji, come for a second now, I apologize, Kimura, something like that. You know, they are the modelers to then let the animators do their job. And so just like that, I'm an animator, not a modeler. If I could learn, I could. I would want to, but, you know, it took me 5 years to get to where I am now with one. I haven't really got 5 years of spare time to get good at modeling. It takes a long time. We have an amazing modeling team on Trek Yards, really amazing, and I envy their speed. But again, some of them envy my rendering abilities, but it's, you know, time put in and some natural ability, but practice, you know.
Okay. When I saw Pierre's work on that ship he did, that looked like it was coming off an aircraft carrier, and it was so believable.
Yeah, he's ridiculous. I mean, the amount of, I hope he's proud of himself, because the legacy he's left is just an imprint on sci-fi you can never, you know, never take away. And even so much as working on, you know, Discovery, he built the Discovery, I don't know if he built the Shinjo, but, you know, stuff you wouldn't, you know, he doesn't promote himself, doesn't get out there, but those who know that they want him, they hire him, and he does tremendous work. You know, I'd love to be able to work with him one day. It's on my bucket list of amazing talent to work with.
And do your flybys get lent or loaned to other productions, or you just keep them?
I have been asked occasionally because, you know, Star Trek fan films, obviously, it's a, you know, a three-tiered thing, you know, the acting, the sets, and the CG. And then, it's many things, but you know what I mean? There's a few really core things. If you don't have one, it's kind of very obvious. And for the longest time, as technology was improving, space CG was almost always bad to okay to medium, you know, and only in the last 4 or 5 years has it gotten good. Certain people like Tobias has been a big part of that, and other people at Contees and such have been very impressive. But you know, I have learned the skill as a hobby, as I've wanted to, and so people have asked me, you know, ooh, can I use this shot of the Prometheus, was a good example for my fan film. And I'm like, well, it's only rendered at, you know, 746 by 383. it's not going to look good on a full screen setting, because that's not how we did it. And re-rendering it would take a long time. And besides that, it's not designed for that. You want to have a more beautiful shot for a fan film. So I've been asked, but they're not really for that medium. You know, if I'm doing something fresh, it needs to be for purpose. You know, I recently did some freelance CG for Star Trek Intrepid, you know, Nick Hook's wonderful series. And he had multiple shots throughout his piece. He sent me the rough cut and I watched it, and I had to see the whole thing, so I had to understand the pace of the, you know, da 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 from ad break, you know, those sorts of beats. And so I designed all the shots around what the moment, what the pace of that few seconds were. And so, you know, you shouldn't, you know, stock shots are fine, but you do design to be blandly stock shots. So, you know, I would rather do custom each time if I can.
Okay. We're going to move on to, you've got an upcoming movie coming out, which we're talking about, called Temporal Anomaly. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Get some fans excited about what they're going to see. But you've worked on many other movies as well, is that correct? So is the list as long as your arm, or?
It's gone kind of long without really meaning to. Yeah, I mean, I've been in the public profile for 3 and a bit years now on Temporal Anomaly, on Track Yard. So, I mean, people have seen my work, and I'm, you know, part of the Star Trek lexicon now for some fans. And yeah, I was asked by Glenn Wolfe a couple of years ago to do some CG. Absolutely did some stuff for him. His previous guy took, you know, 3 months to deliver 2 shots, and I managed to get all of his remaining shots done in a couple of weeks and to a higher standard. You know, and it amazed me the other guy could call what I did Space CG. So that was wonderful. And getting to do some 1080p narrative trek was lovely, you know, working with these ships and trying to do fun angles. And I've worked on Republic, Starship Republic. That was a wonderful project. I was given storyboards for that, which was unusual. But I got to sort of tweak them because the 2D storyboard doesn't necessarily reflect the 3D space. And so I had to, but the team there is tremendous to work with. I've got an untitled project that's been working on for the last year, which will be awesome, which I can't really, talk about yet. Intrepid. And yeah, Intrepid was the last one. I did it this year. Nick put out a general call for CG. I'm like, yeah, I've got to help. I mean, come on, Intrepid's amazing. I've just got to be able to help. So I said I'll do some shots. And I did. I think I've got 8 shots in that film, which I'm very proud of. I'm really excited to see what people think, because you've never seen Voyager look like that, the Intrepid class. So yeah.
Right. Okay. So you're in great demand, which is fantastic. The hope is that it would translate into more professional work. You know, it's great doing fan work, but you know, there isn't a lot of cash available for fan work sometimes.
Well, I'm not good enough to charge, you know, professionals for professional CG. If I ever go into one field, it'd be camera work. But obviously that does translate in the CG world as well. But yeah, I'm, you know, that's my real world skill as cameramanning.
Right, we're moving on. We just mentioned a moment ago that you've got another movie, which has been quite a while in the making, but yes, is finally going to be released to the public. We don't have a release date for it yet, but it's called Temporal Anomaly.
Yes.
So without giving spoilers away, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's going to happen there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you saw the trailer. That's come out. Kind of a surprise to the fans. You know, I started this, I was one of the first Kickstarters, which seems like a long time ago, because it was, 2013, after Renegade's done theirs and sort of started that, oh, you can do that. The fan film Star Trek Deception, which was another English one, started, and I knew I wanted to do a fan film as well. I just finished my, Stargate fan film. Stargate Universe Distant Hope, which is still, after 6 years, the number one Stargate fan film on the internet, on YouTube. You can just search that, and I'm still very proud of that. And, you know, that was my big teenage, young adult love was Stargate, and through life events, I've met every cast member in every show, pretty much. Just, that's one of the things I did. But Trek was always my youth love, you know, my from birth, you know, from two, as I said earlier. And I already had a lot of props, and I was like, this is what I want to do next year. You know, I did Distant Hope in between my first and second year of uni, because, you know, I wasn't going to go home for the summer. I was going to do something really cool. And so I, you know, booked the studio we had and I filmed this. I got actors and I had a really great time. And between second and third year, I thought, no, I'm going to do another film, bigger this time, a 20-minute film. End up being a 60-ish minute script, 55-minute script. It took a week to film it. I kickstarted it, struggled to raise the money. But at that time, you know, what I really showed was enthusiasm rather than quality. Luckily, the script was ambitious and holds up really well. And because I had a filming background, the video clips are still really good and the green screening was really high quality. So, you know, as the years have gone on, I've made the whole film probably about twice at this point, in different iterations. And we had to wait a year for reshoots. That was the big delayer. So that was, you know, 2014. But every year, every 2 years, I've tried to sort of redo it. And not so much the video edit part of it, because that's always been quite solid, but the space effects, the backgrounds, you know, you've got to look realistic in your environments. And so as I've got better with Trek Yards, as I've got more context, as we've gained a 3D team, which is amazing, I've been able to slowly, you know, work my way on Temporal Anomaly. And now 5 years later, the film is something the piece, I'm tremendously proud of and is so much better than I could ever imagined back in, you know, 2013. And the 27 backers who helped me, many of which are actually my friends and family who love the idea. So it's only like 17 unknown people. They will get a movie that's so much better than what they backed.
That's good to hear. Do we have a release date for Temporal Anomaly?
Yeah, the trailer has come out around the anniversary of the launch of the Kickstarter, which was February 19th, 2013. And so I want to have the film come out either at the end of the anniversary of that campaign, so 30 days after that, or if it's just done a week early, I'll release it a week early. So it'll be within the next 30 days. So in March of this year for sure. I'm in the very, very last stages. Literally today, as we recorded this interview, I've done a watch yesterday, did 4 pages of teeny notes just to get all those little things ironed out before I'm sending off a review copy to people like Tobias Richter and Doug Drexler and Rick Stern, but, you know, my celebrity friends, as it were, because I really want to know what they think and get some great feedback from Tobias and such, to make those last changes. And obviously show the cast, who I'm surprising most of them because they haven't heard much from me in the last 3 years. So yeah, very, very soon, and I'm really excited. I want to get it out of the way and get the fan reaction, because it's a story that I've wanted to put out for years, obviously, and it would have been great in the 50th anniversary, because it's, you know, it's a true testament and love of Star Trek film, in that it's got every era of Trek. You know, it's got a character from TOS, from Enterprise, an X-1 era, from Wrath of Khan era, from the TNG and Voyager with, you know, different uniforms, and then the First Contact era. You know, it has a character from each, has a ship from each, all interacting because of some reason, which you'll see. And so it celebrates 50 years of Trek. And even, you know, Discovery's come out. I have put a Discovery reference in there. You know, I didn't have much flexibility with a film that was filmed 5 years ago before it was even remotely green, you know, remotely thought of. But I put a Discovery reference in there, just to include every era.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing this. What are your ambitions for the future, Sam?
Well, that's tricky. You know, we just finished our Discovery season, and the, you know, 7 days a week content on that, which has been a struggle in terms of time management, but it's been rewarding. It's been a great season to look at, discuss, analyze, and so, I mean, we're an analyzing show, so that's been great fun. Now it's to develop Trek Yards even further. We've got a spin-off idea, which we're really excited about. Do more CG for fan films if they want me, as I love just making Star Trek looking space shots. I mean, I have the skills, so it's great to be able to, you know, give films a firm foundation of space CG, you know. I'm hopefully directing another fan film later this year, and I am writing currently-ish not a sequel to Temporal Anomaly, but something that has never been done before in the fan film world, and it might be my swan song sort of thing. And it's weird to say, since no one has heard of Temporal Anomaly until, you know, today, but it's been on my mind for a while. Another project, because the amount of things I've learned is a lot. And so I'd love to do a piece that really reflects, you know, the 2018 quality. And getting Temporal Anomaly out the door in 2018 is my opening the door for the next project, and hopefully showing everyone something truly special.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, Sam, this is part one of a two-part interview. And in part two, we're going to be talking about temporal anomaly. In part two, we're going to be talking about temporal anomaly in greater detail.
Spoilers, yeah.
Spoilers and everything else. So I'm going to kind of wrap up here, but it's not really wrapping up because in the blink of an eye, as podcasts go, people will be tuning in to part two.
Mm. Well, I have a question for you. You know, you watch the trailer. What do you think the story of temporal anomaly is?
Because then we can see if you're right or wrong by the
I'd like to be able to say, well, no, it's a mystery, isn't it? It's you always have to solve a problem, and somebody from the future has created something in the past that's gone wrong in the future, and they have to come back again and put it right, but it never gets put right, and it has knock-on effects. It's very difficult to tell from the trailer. Picked all the really exciting parts and stuck them in there. And,
yeah,
the films that we really need to know are hidden in the background.
The film's a very difficult film not to spoil. And so I had to pick clips very, very carefully. Yeah, but there's little hints there.
Are there any Suliban in there? I didn't.
Well, you wouldn't see, would you?
This is true. Yeah, okay. I hate wrapping up interviews because they're so interesting. But as I said before, this is just part one of a two-part, and then when we come back in part two, we're going to be discussing the film in greater detail, how it got made, how it started, how long it took, who's behind it, who's in it, and all those interesting details.
Looking forward to it.
But for the moment, we're really talking about you, Sam, and where you came from and how you got into the business and involved. So for the benefit of people listening to the podcast, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me, well, almost every day, a little bit less now after Discovery's over, at Trekyards on YouTube. You can see my English face every bit there. Or again on Trekyards on Facebook. We're very active. We've got a group and a page. The group is amazing. If you want to discuss spaceships or tech, that is the absolute best place on the internet to do so. You know, we're very, very focused, and we get dozens of posts about ships a day. We're quite heavily moderated, but that's to keep the focus, and people love it. You know, always great things to see. That's really it. You know, I'm visible through my work, not so much as a public figure sort of thing, but I'm, you know, you can tag me in comments and say hi and stuff. Or you can, search Power 543 Fan Films. That has my Stargate film, which is Stargate Universe, Distant Hope, and the original Temporal Anomaly trailers, and then this new one now.
Fantastic. Okay, can I say on behalf of everybody at Trek FM, thank you for coming on Continuing Mission today. And I know we'll be chatting to you fairly shortly again, and I'll thank you again at the end of that interview.
and thank you for the invitation and coming on this, you know, the definitive Trek radio station in the world. I mean, it's great to be here.
Good to hear it. Okay. Sam will be returning to us in the very near future to reveal all the details about his fan film, Temporal Anomaly. If you'd like to view the trailer for the movie, you can find the link to it in our show notes, or you can search for it on YouTube. It's under the title Star Trek Temporal Anomaly 2018. We have a ton of Star Trek thoughts and discussions going on across the Trek FM network, so here are some of the shows you may have missed.
Previously on Trek.fm, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
Star Trek is more than just average television. I mean, I know I'm going to say that as a Trekkie fan. Everyone's like, yeah, of course you're going to say that. But Gene Roddenberry started out with a vision. He wanted to make television that broke barriers, was about social commentary, that got people to think, that widened people's minds. He didn't just want to make television that was financially successful.
Literary Treks.
I'm wondering if there's kind of a bit of a parallel there with Narinda and the totality not knowing what love is.
That's
very good. You know, they just need a certain song sung to them. know what love is. Something like that. Anyway, there you go. That's all you're going to get out of me.
I was just waiting for that. I watched you hesitate, like, am I going to do this? And boom, you went there. I loved it.
Standard orbit.
What lends credibility to all of this is these were concepts that came up from the writers at the time. It's not you and me saying, hey, what if we do this? What if we do that? Which I'm sure would be extraordinarily entertaining for our listeners. But, you know, when you're actually looking at things that, you know, were written out by the writers at the time, you see the similarities and you see the struggle with creativity in time.
Earl Grey.
You know, out of all this, I mean, you can see throughout the whole entire episode, you see the frustration that Data's going through, trying to go through these protocols that I'm sure he's going through, and then he has to actually choose some kind of violence in order to get his point across. Like, hey, you need to go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Do check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us email, you can use the form on our website at trekfm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Continuing Mission. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Before we leave you today, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, our publisher and executive producer, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, executive producers, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutella, our Patreon manager. All these people work very hard to make Trek FM a possibility for you, and we're all very grateful for your listenership and participation. If you would like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. I'm Tony Robinson. You've been listening to Continuing Mission, and do join me again in the very near future for the next exciting episode. So all I can say is live long and prosper.